From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in July of 2014 when a company called Energy Transfer Partners announced a $3.78 billion project that you know as the Dakota Access Pipeline. It has been a controversial project, to say the least. A number of Native American tribes have opposed it, and in recent months, protesters from across the country have gone to Standing Rock to show solidarity with Native Americans. On Sunday, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline. That was seen as a major but perhaps temporary victory for those who have opposed the project. Donald Trump has said he supports the project and he will re-examine it after his inauguration. Some of the protesters at Standing Rock are from our region, and they've asked to come in and share some of their experiences along with their feelings about what lies ahead. 566 protesters, I should say, have been arrested at the site since mid-August. And CBS News recently spoke to Standing Rock Sioux Chairman Dave Archambault II, who is now asking protesters to go home, at least for a while. He said to CBS News, quote, "I understand the fear they have that this is just a small victory and it's not over yet. But it's over right now," end quote. Is it? Let's talk about that. My guests for the hour include Luke Watley, who protested at Standing Rock for 2 weeks in September. That's correct, Luke. Nice to see you. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, yes,
and also went back a second time.
Very good. Okay, so you've been there two different occasions.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Angel Jimerson is with Friends of Ganondagan, a youth leader who protested at Standing Rock. And Angel, thanks for taking the time to come in here.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren Jimerson is a project manager for Ganondagan's Iroquois White Corn Project. It's also been to Standing Rock. Lauren, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Isabel Barter is, let's get this right, a medic at Standing, well, there's a lot to share about it. A medic at Standing Rock?
Yeah, a medic, as well as going with a delegation from Rochester with the International Socialist Organization.
Okay, thanks for being here.
Appreciate
having you. And Lisa Giudice protested at Standing Rock as well in September. And Lisa, nice to see you as well. Thanks for being
here.
Thank
you.
Okay,
so
five of you here, there are so many from the Rochester region who have been there, who are there now. Mm-hmm. I just talked to some folks who were leaving on Friday and Saturday. And of course, then we get this ruling on Sunday from the Army Corps of Engineers. And Luke, right before the hour began, I read Archambault's quote, who said, it's over for now. And he is asking protesters to go home, that this is a moment to kind of catch your breath and to try to now reach out to the Trump administration and say, let's continue this way. Is it over for now? What do you think, Luke?
It's not over. DAPL has promised that they will not stop, that they will continue. And Dave Archambault's view of that is that it's a threat, that they would actually not go with their threat. But I don't think anybody believes that. I think that most people who are there believe that they will keep digging and they will go under the river despite what the Obama administration has asked them to.
And do you expect then protesters who are there now to stay there or for people to keep going there now?
I think I hear people from all over the place wanting to go. I hear from the people in place that they want to stay.
Even after Sunday, this doesn't change.
I've heard a lot of people have left, but I don't know. I haven't seen videos of actually proof of that.
Okay.
But no, most of the people that I'm aware of over there are staying.
All right. Panel, anybody disagree? Anybody think it's over for now? Everyone should go home? That this is a moment? You're shaking your head. No?
No, I don't think it is. Even after the Army Corps of Engineers statement, the Energy Transfer Partners and Sunoco came out with a statement that said nothing this administration has done today changes the fact that they're going to drill under Lake Oahe, that they're going to continue with the pipeline. That was just a day after the decision, not even a full day. It was actually released at 8 in the morning the next day. So I don't think that Energy Transfer Partners plans on changing their tactics or methods. They've stated over and over that this is a $50,000 a day fine to them, and that's nothing to them in their projections. It doesn't even change anything. So if they're going to keep drilling, we're going to keep protesting, and we're going to stay there.
Okay, Lisa, agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have to say something, or I might get the wrath. Protectors, we're protecting the water. Really like to be called protectors.
Protectors.
Thank you.
You got it. And so in your view, Archambault's urging for protectors to kind of disperse for a while is misguided?
I honestly have a lot of respect for him. Mm-hmm. I've met and talked to him, and I think he's concerned for people. But I do know that out of the hundreds of responses that I've read, no one is budging. No one is budging. They've been asked to stop digging before and have never done it, and they've made it very clear that they're not going to. So I personally think it would be a big mistake to walk away.
Do you have any plans to go back?
Yes.
You do?
I don't have definite plans, but I definitely intend to go back.
Okay. And that has not changed?
No.
Okay. Angel, how do you feel about it?
I feel that a lot of people do not want to leave until they know for sure that they're going to stop digging and that the pipe is officially taken out so far, or whatever they've done has been put back to how it was. So I know a lot of people who actually still want to go out there. And even though this has happened, they said that they're not allowed to dig. Everyone knows they plan to keep digging. So.
Okay. Lauren, agree?
Yeah, I would agree.
So go ahead. And I know we're all squeezed into the studio, five people and four microphones. But Lauren, do you have any expectation that we'll see fewer people wanting to go there, or that this is sort of an end point for a while to this?
I don't think that it is an end point. You know, the people that I spoke with when I was there, you know, are a lot of them are there until like the end. And, you know, I don't think we see this as the end. You know, people are willing to die protecting this water. And I heard them saying that. And, you know, what I've seen on Facebook and on Twitter, they're not going to leave. And you know, like everybody else has said, you know, there's still people that want to go out there. And, you know, I've thought about it too, you know, if it continues, you know, there possibly, you know, there could be another trip in the future.
Okay. Listeners, I want you to know, if you've got any questions or comments, no matter, you know, sort of what side you're on, so to speak. You know, maybe you think that you'd like to see the project go forward. Maybe you agree with President-elect Trump on this. And if you want to share different thoughts, you're welcome to do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. This panel is going to now, I think, have a chance to explain what it's like there. Most of us haven't been there. What we're seeing now are some really tough conditions and some really devoted protectors, as Lisa said, who are committed to a cause there in really, really difficult conditions, difficult travel conditions. And but they've sort of been there at different times. And so what I want to do is allow them to explain what their experience has been like. And Lauren, why don't I start with you? You were there in Standing Rock when?
We went, we got there the night of Thanksgiving, and we stayed there until Sunday, that Sunday.
Okay. Set the scene a little bit. What was it like?
So, you know, I've been following the story for quite a while, and, you know, there's, I've been hearing about this sort of majestic visual when you come upon camp, but it was like pitch black when we got there. But we felt it when we entered. You know, this woman at the entrance will tell you, you know, there's no drugs or alcohol, there's no weapons. She also told us that, you know, we're matriarchal here. Women and children come first, and men support us. And so I had a friend that kind of led us into camp because he knew where we needed to go. And you know, when she got done talking, you know, I said, Angel, I said, we're here, we made it. And I started to roll up my window, but then, you know, we smelled the campfire and we could smell sage and tobacco burning. And, you know, I looked at Angel and I'm starting to get emotional here again. You know, I started to cry and I said, can you feel it? And there was singing. And so we both rolled down our windows, you know, as we drove down what's called Flag Row, which is the main drive-in. And, you know, we went in the blanket of night, but it was still this really powerful feeling entering the camp. And when we got to our camp, you know, we were surprised to find that My cousin was camped out there, and they actually, people got up and helped us put up our tiny little two-person tent, and it took like 5 minutes. But, you know, experiencing the people being united like that was just very moving and very powerful. You know, everybody was there for the same purpose, and that's to, you know, protect Mother Earth and all the inhabitants and, you know, her resources. And I don't know, just the strength and that unity that was there. I don't know what else I can say.
Well, let me ask Angela. Why don't you sort of add to that? What would it felt for you?
It was an amazing, like, it was a wonderful feeling to go in to, yeah, into rolling down the window and having these smells of a campfire and sage and tobacco. And then on top of that, hearing all these people just walking around and singing. And they always had every night people singing over the microphone, so they were over the speakers, and you could hear them all throughout the camp, and it didn't matter where you were, you could always hear it, and it was a wonderful feeling. And when we got to our camp, a lot of people came up and helped us set up our tent, and they were saying, if you need anything, we have everything. And honestly, if you go there, you probably don't even need to take much, because they have everything for you. They have food, they have tea, they have clothes. So if we were ever short on anything, if we were ever cold, like, they always had blankets. They had an air mattress for us. They had extra clothes and tea, and it was a wonderful experience.
What has the media or the critics gotten wrong about the protectors there?
Well, I've been commenting on this a lot, because, you know, while we were there, I had a lot of friends saying, you know, wishing for our safety. And I was really appreciative of that. But, you know, that kind of gave me the feeling that people are really focused on the violence that happened there. And, you know, the violence was not on part of the water protectors there. You know, it was the law enforcement that was enforcing the law using violence. And, you know, we actually, we commemorate Canandaigua Treaty every Veterans Day. So, you know, I go every year and I listen to the speakers that speak. And this year we had Alex Hamer, who's a photographer for Indian Country Today. And he was the one that actually told us, you know, he said that himself and showed us pictures. And he said, you know, it's a very youth-centered place, family-oriented. You know, it's a movement that was ignited by the youth. And, you know, and they have all these activities at camp for you to do. They have art tents and stuff like that. And he said, you know, there's concerts at night. They have hip-hop concerts, the singing that happens. You know, every night we went to sleep with singing, and every morning we woke up to singing, sunrise ceremony and water ceremonies. And you know, various different languages, you know, different nations representing, and, you know, us being Seneca, you know, it was just a great feeling, you know, because we have our own ceremonies, and some of our own people, you know, would do our ceremonies, and that was just really beautiful to see and hear and feel. So, you know, I think a lot of people just really focused on the violence that happened there. And I think that's easy to do. And, you know, no doubt should that be a conversation. But, you know, the peacefulness and the prayerfulness of the actual camp of the water protectors, you know, should also be part of that conversation.
Let me just jump in and say, David and Rochester, we're going to come to you soon here. And then as we go throughout the hour, you're going to hear all of our guests who are in studio tell their stories. I just happened to start with maybe the most emotional one in the room, which is Lauren and Angel. But I do want to follow with one question for you, Lauren, because I asked, you know, what some of the misconceptions are. Mm-hmm. I saw a very snarky tweet from someone who is, I think, very much in favor of the pipeline project being approved, saying, boy, you know, something to the effect of, well, boy, these protesters look a lot like the Occupy Wall Street protesters. And they look like a lot of protesters who show up at a lot of these events, and they're mostly white. They don't look like, you know, Native Americans. As someone who's Seneca, I kind of want to counter this idea that if most of the protectors are white, that there's something wrong with that, or that there's something problematic about. How does it make you feel to see a wide range of people represented there?
I thought it was wonderful to see a wide range of people represented, you know, and I mean, you know, we should be kind of opening up these doors where we understand each other like that. And I mean, the other thing, you know, I think that's kind of a really big misconception to talk about, too, is that, you know, Native peoples come in all different colors, sizes, shapes. You know, we all don't look like, you know, the Hollywood Indian, you know, with, you know, bronze skin and long flowing straight hair. You know, I think that's like a large misconception. You know, and that's something that kind of plays on our identity that, you know, I myself growing up as an individual, you know, seeing these, you know, portrayals in media, you know, like, Princess Tiger Lily and Peter Pan, you know, that's the idea that we have of what a Native American looks like. And that isn't true. But I really did appreciate, you know, the different peoples being there. Everybody, you know, was there.
Angel, yeah. You want to jump in? Go ahead.
It's not just a Native American problem either. It's also a problem for not just us now, but also our future generations. And as youth, I am looking out for not only my generation, but my kids, my grandkids. And because if we don't stop this now, at some point, what if we don't have water anymore? How are we supposed to live? Because we're made out of water. Everything we eat, we drink has water in it. Mm-hmm. And so why would you want to contaminate it with something that we can't put in our bodies? So it's not just a Native American thing, you know. It shouldn't matter whether you're Native American, you're white, African American, or any race. It's a problem. It's a human thing. Mm-hmm. It's not a race
Absolutely.
Thing.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing a lot of nods around the room. So we're going to make sure we get all the different perspectives in. But let me grab our first phone call because David in Rochester has been waiting. Go ahead, David.
Yes. In regards to that previous Twitter, I'm a veteran, and I am extremely proud of the veteran representation, black, white, or whatever color. That's not my question. My question is with the incoming administration, and I'm not a big flag-waving anti-Trump man. I really feel that the decisions that are to be made, if there's any sincerity in Donald Trump, he should recuse himself from making any decision in that part, being that he's an investor in that reality. Thank you.
Thanks for the phone call, David. And just to sort of repeat there, especially because not everyone in the studio has headphones, he's pointing out that Donald Trump has stock in one of the companies and has sort of a financial stake and potentially in the outcome here, and that there should be some real concern about that. I saw people nodding around the table.
I could address that a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead,
I read, I think, yesterday or the day before that he had sold his investment, but he still has friends. I mean, where is the conflict of interest? How is there accountability for that? So I can't speak really to that because I'm not a politician, but there's concern.
Yeah, and I would just say, I think We in the media are really challenged to understand what conflict of interest means with this next administration. I'm not being snarky. I'm not claiming that there's never been a conflict of interest in government until Donald Trump, or that the Democrats have never had one. Far from it. But I think there's a real challenge right now. John writes to the program and says, Evan, who paid for your guests' travel time and living expenses? Have they received payments in the past for other protests? Are they professional protesters? See, this is what. So, Lisa, you jump on that one. Go ahead.
Oh boy, I might be the wrong one.
Does that question insult you, by the way?
A little bit. Yeah. No. I don't know anybody. I will definitely say we started a GoFundMe to help with our expenses out there, and you know, for most of us, I know it's really hard for people to believe that if it's not hitting their heart as much as it is ours, or if the call is not as strong as it is for us, we do walk away from everything. I mean, my business is at risk, my home is at risk, but we went out there with 120 in our GoFundMe and just trusted. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people who've done the same thing or given up even more.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I think most people who are out there are just normal working people who have some sort of skill to offer, who take sometimes all of their remaining, you know, PTO off at work. And I've known people who are there who are taking time off now that they would have been taking off for Christmas, and instead are going to spend Christmas Day with their family and are spending the rest of their time off for the holidays at Standing Rock. I know many people who have left their jobs to go. When we left, we had absolutely no funding whatsoever. We thought we were just going to pay for travel costs out of our pocket. And, you know, we would, you know, pitch a tent. We actually went with somebody who was in Occupy and actually did stay in Occupy Rochester at Washington Square Park for the entire winter. And so we thought, well, he's got to know how to stay warm. So, but in all honesty, you know, most people, I think, there are paying for it out of their own pocket for the most part. And then if people are lucky enough, they have, you know, people giving to a GoFundMe sort of thing or something like that. But the camp is well supplied as far as food and places to keep warm goes. So other than just finding winter shelter, which has only just started to become a problem, getting out there and giving your labor is really the most important thing to be doing anyway. It's not like people are going there with thousands and thousands of dollars and then giving it to the camp.
I would caution John, who wrote in with that question, not at all to condescend, but just to say, in the spirit of our recent discussion on this program about fake news, there's been a lot of fake news about professional protesters getting paid. And John and others, if you find outliers, okay, I will tell you, it was exceedingly easy to find guests for this program. We could have filled the building probably with local Rochesterians and Finger Lakes residents and people in this region who have gone to Standing Rock. The Lutheran pastor who was on this program last week has talked about how he has considered going. This is not a case of people signing up to get paid to go protest. It was very, very easy to find people from all walks of life who have been or are going. And I say that not to say John or others, again, if you oppose what the protectors are doing and if you support Dakota Access Pipeline, that's one thing, and I understand that. But this is not a case of, and I think it's unfair and frankly it is disrespectful to those who have taken the time to go to imply that they're sort of paid for or bought, and that's just not the case. It was very easy to find folks to fill this room and could have had a lot more. Go ahead, Isabel.
I would like to say, though, that there is a group of people at Standing Rock who are being paid to be there. And that's the several dozen private security guards who have been hired by the company. That's the five different states worth of police officers who are being paid by tax money to be there to protect what is now a completely illegal project by Energy Transfer Partners and Sunoco. The head of Energy, the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, is being paid millions and millions of dollars a year to head up a project which is categorically illegal. They're being paid. If you want to see where the people who are being paid to be at Standing Rock are, they are not on the side of the camps. They are not on the side of Native sovereignty. They're on the side of the pipeline itself.
Here's a question from Tim. He writes, there's nothing wrong with calling yourself a protester. He says the literal definition is a person who publicly demonstrates strong objection to something. He says, also, I don't necessarily disagree at all with the protesters, but from what I know, 90% of the pipeline is complete, and with the total cost being somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 billion, this thing is going to be finished. Again, I'm not necessarily in favor of the project, but I'm being a realist. That comes from Tim in Pittsburgh. Some thoughts
there?
Go ahead, Luke.
That may be a realist position, but that doesn't mean that we can't have ideas about what the future of humanity should be like.
Right.
And from my perspective, when I first decided to go in September, I was thinking, well, if the Missouri River is polluted, that's going to affect millions of people. It's going to pollute the Mississippi River. And then where are those people going to go for fresh water? Well, there's the Great Lakes and there's the Finger Lakes. Mm-hmm. And that affects us directly. So the future of humanity depends on this, on taking a stand. To me, there was no question where I stood on that. You know, if water is polluted, there's no future for humanity. So it doesn't matter to me how many billions are invested. I needed to show my support to the natives who were there.
Do you agree, though, Luke, with Tim, or do you disagree that this thing is going to get done eventually, given the money and given all the work that's already been done? Do you think it can be stopped?
I believe it will be stopped. The natives have told us that they know that if we remain nonviolent, that it will be stopped. They saw it in visions. They saw it in dreams. It may be hard to believe, given the stakes right now. But I think that if we have faith and if we remain nonviolent, that we will succeed. Yes.
All right. Before I get back to the phone calls, then, because I'm trying to work in all of your individual experiences, and I can see we could probably do this all day. The phones are ringing. Luke, why don't you just briefly share your experience at Standing Rock?
Well, I went twice, and the two experiences were dramatically different. The first time I went, it was almost celebration every day. Yes, we went to the front line. There were people attached to the machinery and so on. Jill Stein was there one of the days that we went there. But we were in a smaller camp called the Rosebud, the Chongu Rosebud Camp. That was on the south side of the Cannonball River, right across from the Ochetti Camp. And I tell you, the first time we were there, they were talking in two different stages, singing or doing rap. We could hear them until 2-3 in the morning. There were people from different nations arriving at all times of day and night and celebrating every time, over 300 nations that showed their support during that period of time. The second time we were there, the main camp was very quiet at night. No more of this joyful activity. There was a lot of tension because the pipeline company was going to cross Route 1806 on the side where the Army Corps of Engineer land is. And the natives really wanted to prevent that from happening, and the police really wanted it to happen. And they pushed the natives out of the way. And that it was very, very hard to live through that. And there was a lot of tension. There was a lot of maybe despair and what do we do next? So that second experience was dramatically different, and we all tried and support each other through it.
You're hearing the experiences of five panelists in studio with me, all from the Rochester area, who have been to Standing Rock and are describing their experience there and also describing their feeling after the decision by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer on Sunday to deny the easement for the Dakota Access Pipeline. And now the question going forward, is it over? I don't think anybody thinks it's over, but is this a time to pause and catch a breath, or are we going to see a diminishing of the people who are going there to stand in solidarity with Native Americans, or are we not? So trying to answer some of those questions and understand the experience of what it has been like there at Standing Rock. I'm late for our only break. I'm going to come back to your phone calls and continue to get the experiences of our guests who are in studio. Let's do that next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, a surrogate for Donald Trump recently said in an interview that if the Trump administration decides to go forward with any kind of Muslim ban, that they could use Japanese internment as a legal precedent. And there's been some, well, as you might imagine, some outrage about that. We're going to talk to people who have been impacted about this stain on our history and what this rhetoric means. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Isabel Barter wanted to follow up with one of the points you heard in the opening half hour there. Go ahead.
Sure. I just wanted to touch on what somebody mentioned about realism. I think that when we look throughout history, throughout, you know, anywhere where we have corporate interests kind of butting against the interests of people around, we can see that the only thing that actually does make change, and this is something that I really hope that we get to, because it touches on the Army Corps of Engineer decision as well, which is what do we consider, you know, a victory and what do we consider a final victory? There was a statement made by another member of the camp, another member of the Sioux tribe, LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who said, you know, the chairman doesn't tell us what to do. The chairman isn't in charge of the camp. We stand, we don't move, we don't go nowhere. And that was her response to the chairman's comments. And I think that speaks to what so many of the rest of the water protectors know about this, that we aren't done until we're really done, until we could take a piece of the Dakota Access Pipeline home as a prize. And I think that we saw this in Bolivia. There's a film called Even the Rain about Cochabamba, which is a protest movement that broke out when the Bechtel company there was trying to privatize the water around Cochabamba. And the only reason that a huge multinational billion-dollar company, which was promised the water of this particular town, this particular city, was stopped, even though they were already promised it by the Bolivian government, even though they had already decided that they'd already bought the rights to the water, the only reason that they were stopped is because more or less a general strike and extreme militancy, not violent militancy, but extreme, you know, unwavering refusal to move of the people in Cochabamba. And you can watch Even the Rain and see this in a bit more dramatized way. When we talk about how do we win, native sovereignty over their own land, I think this is a perfect example. We do it by mass, multiracial, working class movement, fighting for what it is that we want. And you know, we do that in this case at the call of you know, the native elders there. But in any case, anywhere where corporate interests are threatening human life, then we do that completely self-organized. We just have to go out and do it. And I think that's where the realism comes in. You know, that somebody may have said the same thing about the civil rights movement. Oh, what is boycotting a bus going to do? We'll ask that same question today.
I was just going to say the same thing.
Lisa, yeah?
I was just going to say the same thing. I mean, I can be a realist too, but I'm also very balanced with a dreamer, and that was going to be my next question. Some of the greatest changes that we've ever seen were started by the dreamers. I mean, they've been called crazy, I'll keep dreaming. I choose that.
Let me get back to your phone calls. Sean in Rochester is next up. Go ahead, Sean. Do we have Sean? We don't. Sean, are you there? We don't.
Yes, hello?
There you go. Go ahead, Sean.
Yes, first, I'd like to say thank you to all the panelists who are there for going in. Standing up with the water protectors and standing in solidarity with them. I guess my kind of common question, one is, can you guys comment on the significance of so many Native people from all over the country and all over the world coming together, really mm-hmm. for the first time since the Tecumseh, but definitely for the first time since Wounded Knee in the 70s, and then what that means for the future of the movement for to save our environment and the future for indigenous rights. And then the second question is, what was it like there in the camps and in at Standing Rock regarding the how you know the hospital set up, the different kitchens, and basically the creation of the 10th largest city in North Dakota. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right, Sean, thanks very much. Who wants to open with that? I'll open it up to the panel and anybody who wants to jump in there.
Sorry. yeah, so that's actually a point that I've been making for a little while. When you look at the numbers of people in Standing Rock in the three camps combined, especially on the weekends where they see a surge, the three camps combined is the 10th largest city in North Dakota. And when I say city, it's entirely accurate that it is a city. What I saw there was two functional schools, one in Sacred Stone and one in Ocheti Camp. What I saw there was what amounts to a working hospital with different wings. I mean, you guys can talk about that as well.
Yeah, it was awesome to see it. Just real quick, you could walk up there and no, there was no judgment. Would you like Western medical treatment? Would you like to work with herbal? Would you like energy work? Would you like body work? I mean, it's amazing. It's yeah. Amazing.
I was working in the medical tent in you know what amounts to a trauma center. I mean, we're not. There were some things where we were sending people off to a hospital or something like that, but just the level of, and there was a construction company there, more or less. I mean, it wasn't a company, not in any traditional sense, but there was a crew that came in of you know. People who were volunteers who said, yep, I can do construction, and they organized themselves completely on their own and formed a company that was going around. One of the most important divisions of which right now is the winterization crew. I don't even know what you would call it. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's important to recognize that it's important to recognize this because this is the organization that the working class is already capable of doing. We already run society. We already know how to treat injuries and build things and to teach children and to take care of our elders. Just the fact that people were given the opportunity to do that and to self-organize to do that at these three camps is incredible, and to watch it happen before your eyes is incredible. And I just would like to point out that, you know, there is one place in this country where anybody who wants it can get universal health care, and that is at any of these three camps.
Absolutely.
Any person who would come in and say, I have a broken bone, I need stitches, I need antibiotics or whatever, would have gotten it in the main medical tent in the Medic and Healer Center at Ocheti Camp.
So, all right. Before we go back to the phones, Lisa, you're the last to kind of get to your own experience there. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience in Standing Rock?
It's really hard to sum it up. I agree with what Luke said as far as trip one to trip two. It was very different, but yet still beautiful. I've said to a lot of people, I've never once been in a situation where in one day you could absolutely experience every aspect of the spectrum and every emotion capable, and that can change within minutes. You can go from being so sad and so angry for brief moments. You know, we went to the front lines every time an action was called, but the resilience is just absolutely incredible. I mean, you will see people cry together, you know, within minutes of that and laugh together, and it's just mind-blowing. I don't even know. It's really hard to describe it, and I think I can speak for anybody that I've talked to that's been there. It's really, really hard to walk away from that. And it's really, really hard to be home.
It's hard to be home.
It's very hard to be home. It's hard to be home when your heart's there.
Well, a phone call from Judith in Irondequoit wants to share some thoughts about what she's hearing from our panelists. Go ahead, Judith.
Thank you so much. And I'm so grateful for this program. I want to thank these wonderful people. I'm just so deeply touched by this program and by their witness, which coming as it has done during this season now at the course of Advent, but before the season of harvest, it's such a magnificent message to all of us about the greatness of creation, as well as about the issues of justice. And I've been praying every day for you and have been one of the people who called the White House, but I'm calling now to ask you if you can tell me what further things we can do to be of support to you, to be a part of this if we can't be with you physically, as I wish so very much that I could be. Okay, what else can we do?
It's a question that's not uncommon. We've heard from a number of people already today just saying, if I can't go, is there something I could do? So thank you, Judith. How would you answer the question?
Can I say something real quick? First of all, it's really, really nice to hear people say thank you. But I also look at that and I go, it's a huge, huge honor. It's a huge honor to be a part of it. I often said that to people out there when people come up and say thank you for being here. That didn't even make sense to me because, you know, I turn that right around and thank them for opening people's eyes and bringing this to the attention to so many people. It's something that I've strived to do in our community for so long with my little tiny voice, and I'm really grateful for them for this beginning.
So what can people like Judith do sort of from afar if they're not going to go to Standing Rock and they choose and want to? And again, to state the obvious, WXXI is honoring conversations and voices. You know, we're not endorsing, but we're trying to ask Judith a question for people who can't go but would like to but want to support in other ways. Is there some things I can do, Luke?
I would like to say that what you've been doing, like calling the White House, calling politicians, calling even the banks, the companies that are involved supporting the pipeline company, are huge. The more people get involved in whatever way, the more we are seen as a huge number of people, and that's what influences policies.
And that's going to, I assume that's going to change, the dynamics of that are going to change in January with the new administration, right?
Well, the response from the politicians and the organization might change a little bit, but the more people, I mean, what can they do if a million people call the White House? What can they do if a million people call the governor of North Dakota? The number of people is very, very important, and natives have told us that from the beginning. The other thing is to support somebody who goes. If you can't go yourself, support somebody who goes there. That's how we first got there, even though we had to pay some money from our own pocket, and Lisa risked losing her house, and we went with difficult financial situation, and so any support you can give to somebody who goes is huge. And also participate in local movements. If somebody wants to change your money from a bank to a credit union, it has a huge impact. Money speaks. Those are some of the ideas.
I think something. You know, like you said, money speaks, and you know, definitely we're hearing, you know, big money amounts from this pipeline. You know, billions of dollars is at stake with building this pipeline. You know, and these big companies have you know, their pocketbook that they can swing around like that. But you know, people need to realize that, you know, they can swing their pocketbooks around too, and there's power in people, in numbers of people, and you know, so I think you know, divesting in those companies, you know, researching and finding out what companies are, you know, loaning money to the pipeline, you know, and pulling your money from them so that, you know, so that you're no longer contributing to the building of this pipeline. I think that's a big thing that should be happening.
There's a bank in Norway that already pulled out its investments and sold them as a result of local pressure.
Okay. Lisa as well, go ahead.
I just want to add, it's really simple things too. What I'm seeing a lot of is, or what I ask people to do, is to just talk. Just talk about it. Bring up the conversation. It's still blowing my mind how many people are not aware. And, you know, if you're not on social media, you're just not going to be caught up. And if you're watching the snippets of mainstream, it's not a lot of real truth there. It's not a lot of really what's going on there, and just talking about it is so important. And of course, we thank you hugely for the prayers, because that power should never be underestimated.
Angel?
Going along with, yeah, telling people, I am on social media. I am on Snapchat, and what I did is I Snapchatted my journey to Standing Rock, my way back. While I was there, I made a video on my thoughts and just telling people, viewers on my Snapchat, what it's like and why that was important to me doing that on Snapchat rather than Facebook or Instagram is on my Snapchat as a youth, I have other younger people on there watching my videos, looking at my pictures. So especially trying to get the youth aware because I went on when I got home, I went to talk to one of my little cousins and he didn't know anything about it. And he's like, where'd you go? He said, Standing Rock. What's Standing Rock? And I had to explain to him what we are doing there, what's going on there. Because they're aware that there's something going on. They don't know what. And it's really important to especially talk to your kids about it. Mm-hmm. Talk to the youth. Mm-hmm. Because they are also, the youth is the future. And that's one of the biggest things that I stand for is the youth. So I really appreciate the kids knowing. And even when we were there, there were many kids there at Standing Rock, young kids playing lacrosse and running around. So
we had a baby in our camp.
Yeah, there was a little babies. Baby in our camp.
Lots of babies.
Yeah.
Lots of babies. Yeah. Well, I think our next caller, Andy, I want to make sure I understand. Andy, did you go to Standing Rock?
Hi there, Evan. Yes, I did. I went out earlier in November, and I essentially, my motivation was to show some solidarity and to be with the people there and to pray and meditate with them, and found a much more rich experience than I had anticipated. I brought out some supplies, some warm clothing, food, some medical supplies for the medics there at the Chittishakon, who I have buckets of praise for. They just do a fantastic job there. And I made many friends there, as a matter of fact. And it struck me when I first came out that this was going to be an open journey for me. I wasn't going to go with any expectations except to pray. And I found a useful purpose in being there. I'm a veterinarian, and when I was donating the supplies to the medics tent, they asked me to hang around and help them. And I had patients every day, young puppies with worms and eye infections and skin problems and things like this, and I actually was I made myself useful while I was there. I was impressed that this became a very spiritual experience for me. That it was not just the fact that I was, you know, I believe standing up for the spiritual beliefs of Native Americans there, but also that it was consistent with my own spiritual underpinnings, and I'm very thankful for that I had the opportunity. I should mention, I first learned about them because I was following the work of the Unistoten camp up in Canada, who has also been protesting protecting natural resources in Canada for a long time now, protecting their resources from a gas pipeline going across their unceded territory. And this kind of opens up a huge international discussion, I think, of how we disenfranchise and literally steal from indigenous peoples around the world. We kind of live in a white-centric world, and recognizing that and recognizing the negative aspects of that white-centric world is, it's tough for a lot of people, and I know it's even tough for people who are out there to stand with the people of Standing Rock. We had an orientation at which some people would actually bristle when they were told, when you want to speak here, you first let the natives who are part of this culture here, the Lakota, let them speak first. Then if you're a Native American, then you speak next. If you're a person of color, then you get to speak next. And if you're white, you know, hold it for last. Let the people, let the cultures that have that have been subjected to some of the negatives, or all of the negativity of our white centric culture, let them speak first. And then you can have your say. And well, then you can say your prayers and add your prayers.
And Andy, I just got to jump I just got to jump in only because I'm going to lose the hour here. And
okay.
I just want to thank you for the phone call, and I know our panelists thank you as well. And I wish I could take more. The phone continues to ring. We have others who couldn't get through, a lot of other thoughts to share. I think it's important to end with a question, and I, if I could, I'll post it to Lauren and Angel because we're down to our last minute. Peter Jemison on this program a number of weeks back, before you mentioned the Canandaigua Treaty, mm-hmm. he mentioned how uneducated we are on treaties and what they actually mean and how they are supposed to still be meaningful. And he said Standing Rock is a kind of a test to see if we still honor them. Do you agree with that?
I would have to say that I do agree with that. And, you know, like I said, you can go to Canandaigua Treaty and, you know, I see it as like free, truthful history lessons. You know, I make sure that I go there and I listen to those speakers speak. You know, I've learned so many things, and I think it was last year at Treaty, you know, we also have to be mindful of these treaties, and really you do have to learn about these treaties because there came a point where then it became tools for land grabs, you know, and so, you know, nations were signing their land over unknowingly, but, you know,
But 15 seconds, is this the real test right now to see if we still honor?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah, I would agree.
All right, well, we're going to see, and wish we had more time. You saw with the phones and all the feedback, but I just want to thank our guests for coming in and sharing their time. Luke Watley, Angel, Lauren Jimerson, Laura Giudice, Isabel Barter. And thank you for all the phone calls and all the feedback we have. This is just perspectives of those who have been there. And we wanted this. We haven't done this yet on the program. We wanted you to hear the many people who are taking their own time, their own money, and going and doing that. So thanks to them for sharing their story. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer, and Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and we'll talk with you Wednesday on Member Supported Public Radio.